Thank you so much. Thank you.
Justice, it is so great to have you here tonight with all these students to talk a little bit about your life and your time on the court. Your life has been described as a remarkable American story, starting out in poverty as a child in Georgia, moving to a seat on the nation's highest court. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in the South in the 1950s?
Well, thank you for doing this. You and I are the two least likely people to be up here. Oh, gosh. It's sort of, we're introverts, and I often joke, introverts of the world unite. But that sort of means we have to go to a meeting. First of all, thank you all for inviting me out to be a part of this and to be so warm in your welcome. It's a little embarrassing, I have to say that. This has been at this sort of a long time. I cannot get used to such warmth. There's much made of, you know, where people start. But this is one country where it's what you do with that start that's so important. And I think we're kind of forgetting that. My grandfather always, you know, the people I grew up around, I don't know if you saw the movie The Help.
I did.
But those ladies in The Help were more like the people I grew up around. And when I would go back home, they always thought I was sort of this beacon, this person who was living what they thought should be done. And they would reach in their garments and pull out a dollar. Remember, these are people who made $3 a day cleaning houses and stuff. And they would give me 1/3 of that to, boy, as they would say, I'd use the way they said it, boy, get your education. And so they put a lot of faith in you. And I think this was a part of the fabric of the country. Things are certainly different now, but it was hope, very, very hopeful. And, you know, I have never really disavowed where I came from. I think it's wonderful. I like where I came from. I like when I grew up, where I grew up, and how I grew up. So it's a part of that. But I think what they taught us is you should do something with it, and then what you should do with it.
Well, and one of my distinct memories as a law clerk in your chambers was having a lot of talks about work ethic, and you and your brother used to have to get up before dawn and help your grandfather in the field. How did those experiences and your grandfather's work ethic in particular shape your perspective and influence your work today?
Well, my grandfather's view, things in those days weren't as secular as they are now. His only education, his philosophy came from the Bible. And he believed because of our fallen nature, we were destined to work to earn everything with the sweat of our brow. He would often say that. And you were, part of that was that you had to work from sun to sun. And I've heard that 1,000 times. The problem with him is that he was a literalist. That's what they call, that's sort of what they call us on the court now. If you actually think words should mean something, oh, you're a literalist. So I was actually in Waco. Ken Starr invited me there, another great man, but I was asked whether or not I was a textualist. And I said, I think all of us are textualists, because if you're riding down the street and you see a sign that says stop, you stop. So I think to some extent we're all textualists. You don't say, oh, officer, I thought stop in my jargon meant speed up. Oh, that'll really work. Or I was looking at it more in a normative way, you know.
Did have a lot of an impact and encouraged you in faith. How has your faith how did it help to shape your childhood and then you as you went through life?
You know, it's really, you know, you're a person of strong faith, and you know, we don't go around, we don't bother other people with it. We sort of just mind our business, and it helps us with our own lives. And as those of us who've lived a while, life can have some sharp edges. And I actually walked away from the faith for 25 years. And as I said to you all, I ran away and crawled back. So I'm not leaving again. And I think it gives you a strength. Justice Scalia and I used to talk about this. It gives you a strength to do things the right way. And I think we were blessed with a formation. I was talking with Paul Scalia recently. Justice Scalia used to wonder why we were so much alike. Clarence, God, how did you get here? He would ask. He was really, really funny. But you know, he's from the North, I'm from the South, totally different backgrounds, and yet we agreed on so much. And recently, Paul Scalia said it was our Catholic formation. And I think there's something to that, that we were taught that we were supposed to do things a right way, not use your religion. That violated our oath. But that the oath meant something, and that it meant that, like, we were required to, in grammar school, every paper you had, you start everything by putting JMJ at the top. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. And so for every single paper, you know, and go, I'm in college, you know, JMJ. But you know, seriously, I think it taught you that there was a certain way you did things. There was a right way and a wrong way. That you started with the text, you were honest about it. I mean, it's like your paper on officers. You know, you started. You start with the language. You work through it. It's like what we were trying to do in Chambers, that there was a right way to go through that process, not with the answer already in mind. That was dishonest. And I think that's what and then it gives you the strength that when you find the answer, it's like Professor Blackman was just saying, you know, the introduction, Gene's introduction, that it takes courage sometimes. It takes more than you can think you can muster to stand up and say, this is the answer I found. Just think, again, look at Harlan in Plessy versus Ferguson. Do you think he was greeted with open arms to write what he wrote? And you think that in a society that was quite racialist, do you think that they said, oh, you think blacks are equal to whites under the Constitution? You think they greeted him in warm arms? We're in the South. And I think it took a bit of courage. And I think a lot of times that it's going to require some courage, and I think you get that with your faith.
So we've talked a little bit about your childhood. Then you've talked about how it was kind of tough transitioning from the South up to New England for college and law school. And you went through a period in the late 60s, feeling maybe some anger, being a bit of a rebel. Mm-hmm. What caused you to change out of that, you know?
You know, it was, you know, my grandfather was quite irritated, quite upset with me. I was really not a pleasant human being. And he would literally, when I went home, he would get up and walk out of the room, that he was so disgusted with me. And he would say that I didn't raise you to be that way. That still, I think of that sometimes, it still bothers me. But then we went to Harvard, to Cambridge. We were in an anti-war rally, and then on the 15th, April 15, 1970, and we went over to Cambridge to free the political prisoners. I have no idea which political prisoners were over there. But you never, when you're mad, you never ask sensible questions. And so we get over there, and we riot all night, and there's tear gas and things like that. And the next morning, we were back in Worcester, Massachusetts. And we drove back, and after all of that, and I said, what did I just do? Mm-hmm. And I was walking in front of the chapel at Holy Cross, and I remember standing directly in front of the Blessed Sacrament, and I said, God, if you take hate out of my heart, I'll never hate again. That began the long process, and it was a long process of not responding to things in a hateful way and not being defined by these negative emotions. But that was the morning of April 16, 1970. And I think it took seeing what I had become and what I could become in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to wake me up and to see what my grandfather was seeing in me.
That's great. So those were your college days, and then you went to Yale Law School. And so we've got a lot of students here tonight in the thick of their law school careers.
Good luck.
What did you learn at Yale in your time there that...
That's a trick question, isn't it?
You talk very positively a lot of times about your time at Yale.
Yeah.
I mean, what have you learned, and is there anything you might do differently? What wisdom would you give to people who are students now about how they can make the most of that experience?
This will be sound almost contradictory.
Okay.
But Yale turned out to be the perfect school for me. It was not class-wise, or I'm not going to say it was easy, but it turned out in the end to be, in retrospect, have been perfect for me. What I would do different is I would not be as negative or cynical. I think I allowed myself to be pulled into a world of negativism, cynicism, to use race as sort of an edge toward other people. Not an edge, it's sort of an advantage, but just an anger, a meanness. I think that wasn't right. Mm-hmm. I go back now, I was there recently, and I realize in walking through New Haven what I missed. All the things that I'm really interested in that today that I would experience. There were lectures, there were opportunities, other students with different points of view. I think the dean was just making the point about debate, mm-hmm. you know, to go and to hear other people, to hear people who've traveled the world. I hadn't been any place to have listened. I think Kagan was there to go listen to him. Mm-hmm. There were recitations, there were plays. There was just a way to expand yourself. So I missed that opportunity. I would not, if I were to go to law school today, miss that. There were the opportunity to grow intellectually. And also I would not walk away from my faith the way I did. I think that was the missing ingredient. I think when I look at the kids who, like you, who understood more where they were going and were more anchored, I think most of them had a strong faith in very, very challenging environments. And I would not eschew my faith.
One of the things that people here may not know about you is that you actually do spend an awful lot of time today and throughout your career in law school classrooms teaching. For 6 or 7 years, you've taught a constitutional law seminar with a former clerk. Why have you seen that as something important for you to do with all the time that it takes to prepare?
I think you should learn constitutional law at some point, and I didn't. I could not figure out substantive due process. That really eluded me. I could not figure out selective incorporation, partial incorporation, absorption. I mean, these things did not sound like technical terms to me, but, you know, in seriousness, I enjoy it. I like being around students and small groups. I mean, I'm no good in them. I think a part of it is, I think you owe them more than a handshake. And when I teach, it's just, you can toss things around. We don't proselytize. We don't tell them what to think. And I love it. Just one student said at the end of our seminar, we've been teaching it now 6 or 7 years. And one student said, you know, I will never look at law the same. I have no idea what his ideological outlook was, but what we were trying to do is get them to think, mm-hmm. not to be led, not to be told what to think, not to say, here's the law, you gotta, but to get them to think, to read the cases that we've all read, Lochner, that people have different opinions about, and to dig into it and to think about it. And it's absolutely fascinating when you see the eyes open. There was another young woman who actually shared your undergraduate experience at Maryland, mm-hmm. and she went to GW Law School like you, and then she said, I went to college thinking that I was going to be taught how to think. They told me what to think. So then she said, I went to law school hoping to be taught how to think, and they told me the last 2 years what to think. And she said, finally, this is a class where I got to learn how to think. And she said, will you teach it next semester? I said, oh my God, no. There's no, I think those were the things that really excite me, you know, to see the kids invested in learning, not what their conclusions are, that's their business. But telling them how much work it takes to get to that conclusion. And how, when you reach it, you have an obligation to dig into sort of the vulnerabilities or the downsides of to your argument. Because it's not the gospel. It's an argument. It's an opinion. And it's fascinating to watch them. I enjoy that. I also like choosing courses. When we walked in here, I saw one of the tables had Stare Decisis. People love to toss that around when they run out of arguments. And so I think Stare Decisis is important, but I think we should dig into it if it's that important. And so I taught a course at the University of Georgia Law School with one of my former law clerks to dig into it, to spend time from the beginning to, you know, through the development of that. But it was just it was an interest. Structural injunctions, I taught a course just because people toss around these structural injunctions without asking why. And I wanted to do it outside the context of a case. Because a case, when we get cases, and we've got lots of judges here, and the case has its contours, like this table. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't allow you to wander around mm-hmm. and consider, how did we get here? You've got to decide this case. That's what's in front of you. And it is premised on the existing law. And so the being in a classroom allows you to go beyond it. It's like your article. Okay, that was outside the context. We weren't talking about a government official and a case about the appointment clause. You wanted to go back and take a look at what it meant at the beginning, what officer meant. But you couldn't do that much work in the context of a case. So that's one of the reasons why I teach.
That's great. And not only do you spend a lot of time at a lot of different law schools, but you're also known for a lot of diversity in your law clerk hiring people from lots of different backgrounds. Why have you considered that important, to fill your chambers with lots of different...
I just don't really like the faux diversity that we're all attached to now, where you look at somebody's skin color or these immutable characteristics, and say, oh, that's diversity because this person's black, or this person's a woman, or this person's this or that. I think when you're talking about intellectual pursuit, you're talking about how people think about things, mm-hmm. How they reason about things. So it is fascinating to have kids from a lot of different backgrounds. And I also think up at the court, we're Ivy League heavy. And I truly believe they're smart kids in a lot of different places. That's not to denigrate the Ivies. But, you know, this year, Justice Scalia, again, and I used to talk about this, he tend to like a lot of people from Harvard. But this year I have no Ivy League law clerks. And that's not that unusual. I mean, your year I had no Ivy League law clerks, but I had four really, really bright, if not brilliant, law clerks. And I think you can get them a lot of different places at different points in their lives. You get them out of BYU, you can get them out of Berkeley, you can get them out of GW, you can get them out of Georgetown. I mean, you can get them out of Creighton. I've had them out of Creighton your year. So I just think that and I think it changes the way your chambers operate. And I like kids like yourself who comes from modest backgrounds. I really like to see kids who have had to, whose parents had to worry about replacing the motor in the car, or had to worry about the tuition, had to worry about the new dress. I like kids from that, not kids who feel like it all happens rather easily. And what I find is that these kids tend to have a different perspective on what we do at the court. And I like kids from different parts of the country. The issues from the West, when you see someone in the East and they talk about a water's right issue, we talk about all these sort of exotic issues. But when you're in Western Kansas or Western Nebraska, Eastern Colorado, and parts of California, water is king. You have got to, they understand that. When I first got to the court, you had Justice O'Connor there, you had Justice White was still there. They understood the West. And I'm just using that as an example, that the people from different parts of the country with different experience enrich your environment. And we do that certainly within chambers.
So moving a little bit to your time on the court, this week on social media, I read that Justice Sotomayor was at a conference, and she said that the two of you could not be more different in your judicial philosophies, but more similar in how you interact with people. And so how do you and your colleagues maintain collegiality on the court, even when you often have sharp disagreements on the law?
You know, I don't think, first of all, that I have the gospel. I think sometimes people have an opinion and they think that it was handed down on high to them and there was a burning bush involved. I just think sometimes it's just an opinion. And you can arrive at it in different ways. That is an institution where we have a lot of cases. About half as many as we used to have, which is a separate issue. But we make a lot of work out of a little. I just think we can't take ourselves seriously. We have to take the work seriously. And I think the court has done a fairly decent job. I hope that continues. Justice Sotomayor, her point was simply that I think that we do get along at the court. And it is a civil environment. It seems around us in society where if you disagree, it's like not just that you disagree on that particular issue, but you war against the person. Mm-hmm. And you see it even in the commentary on the court, this effort toward defamation, the effort toward if you can't win the argument, you defame the opponent. You attack the character of the opponent, the intentions, the motives of the opponent. You don't look at the argument. That's our new society. And God forbid if we get what these people are aiming at. Because then, I'm finishing a book on the tutors. And, the net result is that sort of approach throughout society as we go back to the Tower of London kind of a scene. It may not physically be that way, but certainly we're back to that, where you actually, you don't destroy people with the executioner, you execute them with words.
So, yeah, you're always very collegial in your opinions, and yet you are very committed as well to first principles and originalism, even when it means you might not be in the majority in the court. How do you stay true to your principles case by case? Why have you seen that so important to be on the forefront of originalism?
You know, it's, first of all, I have the most principled wife in the world. And, and you know, we have been, I've been very, very blessed. We can be honest with each other. I mean, she doesn't do law and I don't do politics, but it's like there's an honor to, like, you can look your spouse in the eye and know you've done your best. You can look your law clerks, people who matter to you, in the eye. And for all of you, I mean, you're a brilliant person. So you know, I mean, you see, you come to chambers, you see how we do our work, right? And what I promise you all is that there will be no deep, dark secrets. There are no games going on. You know if I'm playing games. You know if I'm cutting corners. I can't go home day after day and dishonor in a dishonorable way and my wife not notice that I'm dishonorable. You all, I can't see you all day after day in the job and not know I'm being dishonorable. And I think ultimately over time your colleagues figure it out. Mm-hmm. And then so much of what you do is subject to scrutiny. And I think, why do the job if you can't do it in an honorable way? Mm-hmm. Why do it? That goes back to my point about how we get here, our faith, et cetera. What if, for example, I were to run into my grandfather again, what would I say then? Mm-hmm. If I had dishonored him? Mm-hmm. So it's not that big a deal. I mean, so people beat you up, they think they are taking something away. I don't think any of us would prefer to be beaten, but I prefer that than to be dishonorable.
You know, one other thing I want to ask you about before we turn to some questions that have been submitted by students is we've just passed the 2-year mark since the court has lost your very good friend, Justice Scalia. How have things changed in his absence for you the past couple of years?
Well, you know, not to the better. You know, he was, for me, a friend. I used to kid him when he was a lot of fun to be around. I mean, they sort of painted him as this tough guy, you know, and he was my friend. He's always referred to me as Brother Clarence. And I would go in and, you know, early on they were saying that he was my boss. And he was very upset about it. He thought I had gotten him into whatever it is I'd gotten him into, and they were blaming him for leading me into it. And so I sat down with him and comforted him and told him, I said, Nino, you know, in this world you're white and I'm black, and that basically means that you're always the boss and I'm the hoss. And that's the white man's burden. It never came up again. But we from the very beginning, there was a trust. And he was someone, he never, unlike much of society, he never had an image of me that I was to live up to. Mm-hmm. He never had a stereotype, like much of what you see in the media or in the country now, is they have an image of what I'm supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And if I deviate from that, something's wrong with me. I always thought that was bizarre. But he never did. Mm-hmm. So you were the individual, you got to define yourself. And it was wonderful. I mean, I could trust him. I mean, I had a friend, and even when we disagreed, it was Brother Clarence. You know, I still think one of my favorites is when he dissented from one of my opinions, and he told me that my opinion was a liberty-destroying cocktail. That was a good one.
He had a way with it. Yeah.
So when we went to lunch at the end of the term with him, And he was sitting there trying to figure out what to drink. And I said, Nino, get your Liberty Destroying cocktail. In short, I miss him a lot.
And we toast him and his family every month that we gather with your former law clerks for lunch. So it's a lot of special memories. So we have some great questions from students, if that's okay to pose a couple of those to you. And I guess everybody knows that you and Mrs. Thomas travel a lot around the country on your RV. So the students would like to know what your favorite trip is that you've taken in your bus.
You know, we absolutely love being together. We have had a total blast. We have been doing motorhoming now for almost 19 years. And we have been to a lot of different parts of the country, but I think that the best part is that it's a shared experience and seeing different parts of the country. It's us and now, of course, our two little dogs. But the, you know, last year, for example, we did the beaches of the Great Lakes. And most people don't realize that they're really gorgeous beaches up there. And we had a total blast. But I think the best part is to see this country, to see the people in the country and the truck stops, the RV parks, the rural places, the flyover places, and just to experience it together. I mean, we see it together. I think it'd be worthless if I did it by myself. But we see it together. We wander around, we have meals together. Sometimes we get in some circumstances where, like you're sitting in a Walmart parking lot and the bus won't start or something, you know.
Do people recognize you as you travel around?
You know, sometimes, we were up in New York at a Pilot truck stop. Not a lot of people stop at Pilot, but I have a Pilot rewards card. See, that's a big deal some parts of the country. So there are all kinds of experiences we have. So I get out, you fuel and you have your gloves and you act like you're a trucker and you kick your tires. You know, and all these 18-wheelers are around. And I'm walking back from paying my bill and there was a black gentleman there who was driving a tanker truck. And he says, "You that judge?" And I said, don't tell him. And he said, "Can I get a picture with you?" And so you have that, and then you have other experiences where they don't, we had a fuel filter problem in a Flying J in Pennsylvania, and these two guys fixed it, and my wife asked me about them, and I said, "Well, they're two great guys. They know a lot about bus. You know, they two guys with a half a set of teeth between them." But they knew a lot about working on engines. It's great. And they were really, really nice guys.
And I recall you talking once about somebody, I think you were at Gettysburg, and someone came up holding a copy of one of your opinions.
He was holding a copy of, I think, on fake parchment paper, of the Maritime Commission? Federal Maritime Commission opinion. And I said, "Why do you have this?" He had run up Little Round Top, Little Round Top isn't so little when you're out of shape. And as you can see, that had a lot to do with, anyway, that's just the second day of Gettysburg, that was a problem. So he runs up there, he has this parchment paper, and he says, "Sign this," breathlessly. I said, "Why?" He said, "That's what this is all about." I said, "Gettysburg was all about the Federal Maritime." Whoa, boy, I really missed something. Oh, boy. But it's great. The regular people, once you get out of this sort of atmosphere where people think they know what you ought to think. That's really always gets me. People know what you ought to think. That'll work. So that was a mumble. It is wonderful out there. People are delightful. And the ones who aren't, you can just start your engine and drive away.
That's great. So one other student wants to know what the best piece of advice was you received when you started on the court from your colleagues.
Oh, I received some great advice. Justice White was, to me, one of the great people. You don't hear much about him, but he said, Clarence, it doesn't matter how you got here. It matters what you do here. All that matters is what you do while you're here. And he said, we all got here different ways. He also, for process reasons, he said, you got to get a system. Then I was early on the court. I was dissenting a little bit. I don't know. I've got this problem. I'm a middle child. So that's some kind of determinism stuff. The court would vote. I was the last vote, and everyone voted to affirm. I would reverse. Then the next case, everyone voted to reverse, and then I was affirm. And I said, you know, maybe I'm doing this wrong. Justice White, who sat at the end of the table next to me, said, Clarence, if that's what you think, that's the way you vote. And that's what I've been doing. So. So. You know, every member of the court I talked to had good advice. Justice Marshall, Justice White, Justice Brennan said that don't change your mind unless you're persuaded. He repeated that when I had lunch with him, when I got it to the court. And whatever you do, don't change your mind unless you're persuaded. And I think that was very, very good advice. It's really interesting to me that when we have nominations for judges, the people you never hear from are people who have done the job. The people you hear from more often are people who have never been judges. And judges tend to not want to say that it is when you have to sit there and to decide cases, the last thing you feel that you're in a position to do is tell someone else how to do it. If they want advice, you can give them counsel, but you cannot tell them how to arrive at a conclusion. So judges, I think, tend to be a bit more reticent about being absolutists about who has a right to be a judge and who doesn't.
Well, since we were talking a little bit about former colleagues of yours, one student's wondering if there's a Supreme Court justice in the past that you feel has not maybe gotten the credit or been remembered in the way that they should have been. Or anybody in the past that you particularly admire from before your time on the court?
I was going to kid and say McReynolds, but I won't. I knew that would get him. You know, I really can't say. I happen to like Harlan. I happen to like to be very, very fond of Byron White. That's, of course, during my tenure. And there are others, but, you know, I think if you went back and you read the opinions, I think you could find something good about almost all of them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to I don't want to pick through that.
That's great. And one more question, if we can. One thing we didn't talk about is your time before you went to law school in the seminary. And so students are wondering how your time in the seminary perhaps has influenced what you're doing today.
You know, I don't know. I think my time actually, I think I touched on that when I touched on faith. Mm-hmm. Seminary was great for me. I went into seminary at 16. People think when they're 16, you're like really kind of going off the rails a little bit. The seminary was great for me because it really upped the ante as far as academic work. We went to school 5.5 days a week, and it was very, very competitive and aggressive. And you learned a lot more discipline. But if I were to look at the things that had a huge impact on forming me. I would have to say the most positive thing, and this is not being gratuitous, is being just being as accurate as I can, probably the most positive thing was when I met my wife in 1986, because I was just a bit negative and sort of, then we sort of, it's better together. And then I would have to add formative as far as thinking about the law was when I was at EEOC in the mid to late 1980s when I ran into Ken Masugi and John Marini and working on that. I think EEOC taught me how to think clearly and calmly while being beaten. That's not so easy. And it got you used to that, that people forget I spent most of my 30s at EEOC and in these jobs. And I think the people there taught me that that people could disagree with you and be really, really good people. I mean, they taught me more even than the academic setting. But, you know, I think my years in the seminary were part of the formation that Justice Scalia was talking about. And if I could pass something on to the students, you know, a theme that I hope would come through is about this atmosphere that we're in of cynicism and negativism. I think that people can profit from that. They can get you worked up. They got me worked up. They can even organize around it. But it's, in the end, and it may feel initially like a drug. It may feel, give you this sort of sense that you're empowered. But it's also destructive. It's destructive of you. It's destructive of people around you. I think to do the hard work to have a civil society, it's got to be more positive. It's got to be more something you're for, not against. And at some point, if you're going to have a country, you got to have something to be for. And I think I've been in these jobs now. I think I started in these jobs in 1981. I'm at a point where I'm more idealistic about it. That the only reason to do it is for the ideal. The only reason to continue doing it, to accept. Again, this is something Justice Scalia and I would talk about. You reach, particularly when you reach a point when you can just hang up your spurs, you do it for the ideal, for the things you believe in. I think we've got to focus on that a bit more. What do we believe in? What do we stand for as a country? What do we want the law to stand for? Not these platitudes that don't mean anything. You know, everybody's for everybody being happy. So what? You know, that doesn't really move the dial any. You've got to actually do something. So I would really encourage the younger people, the older people like me too, that we have an obligation to look for that ideal for which we are fighting, for which we are working, and then to work toward it in a positive way. And I've been saying things like that for now, last 30 plus years. I know what the other side looks like. I know what it feels like, but I don't think it is productive. I don't think you can have a society where we're constantly cynical or negative in the way that we are. You certainly couldn't have a court. You mentioned Justice Sotomayor or Justice Ginsburg, and she's not my enemy. She's my colleague with whom I respectfully disagree. So I think that we have got to, particularly the younger people, as adults, we've got to set the example, but I think the younger people have to set their own pattern of being positive.
Thank you, Justice, so much for sharing so much of yourself tonight and your transparency and for, you know, what you're doing to keep a positive outlook and have a real impact on the law in the country.
Well, thank you. I have to say, you set an example. You know, I watched how you have conducted yourself and what you have done in raising your four kids and then going back to writing what is a seminal article and starting your teaching career. And it's the same thing. If I could take just 1 minute, and asked my former law clerks if I got two or three of them here who would stand up. Do I have any of them out there? Did I see any? And, oh, Mark Paoletta, there he is. And Leonard. They're my adopted clerks. They won't stand up. But I'd also like to another point to make is that it is a real honor. I've been a part of the Federalist Society now since meeting with them when I was at EEOC in the 1980s. And I remember going to Yale Law School when I was at EEOC, going to UVA. I think that what the dean said about this organization is very, very important, that it allows debate. And if we are going to, again, have a civil society, we've got to have civil debates. And I would go a step further and say that's what law schools used to be, where we would actually have disagreements. Certainly, when I was in law school, you could argue about anything. I think that the students have to reclaim that if we are to have a society. We're sort of actuarially, it's you've got a bigger problem than we have. So I think it is incumbent upon you to really take it seriously. And I would, and again, my hat is off to you. It's off to our judges in this room. It's off to the professors. It's off to the leaders, to encourage you to continue doing what you're doing that brings you here and to promote it for these young people. I think it's very, very important. I think it's critical. So again, thank you, and thank you for letting me sit here with you. We two introverts.